The sheets should be around. I hope there are enough. Maybe I was not confident enough in enough people, so maybe people can share if there aren't enough. The last time we had shared a couple of weeks ago, we just, I think, completed the Mishnah, which was the third Mishnah, the third leg.
Boy.
No, it's feast or famine. We can have 25 people, we can have 12 people. So we're on Daf Lamed Tes Amud Beis. We're on Daf Lamed Tes Amud Beis. And we just read the third of the three Mishnayos, where the first was those things that are Asur and Asur Bahana, you can't get any benefit. The second Mishnah was those things that were Asur Bahana, but you're Asur Bachila, you can't eat, but you're allowed to get benefit. And we just read the third Mishnah of the three on Daf Lamed Tes Amud Beis, which was the those things that are mutter to eat, things that you might have thought that there's a problem with it, and the Mishnah is telling you that there actually is no problem. So the first line of the Mishnah, we'll just reread that because that's the opening discussion on the Gemara, is the following. So if you have a milk that a Nachri, that a non-Jew milked, and the Jew is watching, so you're allowed to consume that. So the question, of course, the obvious question would be, what is the Chiddush here? So the Gemara talks about this a little bit. The Gemara says, Tanina laha, Ditana Rabbanan. Sometimes the Gemara has a Braisa, and the provenance of the Braisa or the reliability of the Braisa is not necessarily attested to. And if you can find a Mishnah that supports that particular Braisa, so you say, Tanina laha Ditana Rabbanan. It's not just Stama Braisa that exists in the world, that maybe it's reliable, maybe it's not. But rather, we actually have a Mishnah that confirms this Braisa. And while not all Braises were considered to be reliable, Mishnayos were generally considered to be the basic source of authority. So the Gemara says, Tanina laha detana rabbanan. Our Mishnah would serve as a source for the following. Yoshev Yisrael b'tzad edro shel akum v'oved kochavim cholev lo umevi lo v'eno choshesh. So a Jew can sit next to the flock. Here's the flock of the non-Jew, the animals. And he sits next to it, and the non-Jew milks the animals, and he brings the Jew the milk, and that milk is permissible to consume. So the question, of course, is, Hechi dami, what's the case? If there's no non-kosher animal in his flock, so pshita, what else would you think? If there is a non-kosher animal, the fact that I'm sitting on the side of the block reading the New York Times and the non-Jew is milking the cows, so why is that milk permissible to consume? How do you know that he didn't, at one point, you know, into his milking pail, go milk a pig or milk a camel or milk a donkey? So, thank you. So the Gemara says the following. La'olam de'ika davar tameh. There is a non-kosher animal. So why is it that you're allowed to consume milk? So here's the key point. V'chi ka'i, when the Jew stands up, chazile, he will see the non-Jew. V'chi yosif, but when he's sitting down, lo chazile. He doesn't see him. So right now, the non-Jew is sitting down, the Jew is sitting down, he can't see, but all he has to do is stand up, and he's going to get a very good view. So mahun detema, I would have thought, kevan de yosif lo chazile, if when you're sitting, you can't see it. Maybe the non-Jew will actually go and mix some non-kosher milk in. Kamash malon, it teaches that not so. Why? Kevan dechi koi. Since if the Jew watching could see him standing up chazile, irtuse mirtas, the non-Jew is afraid. Velomi aribe, and therefore he's not going to mix in any non-kosher milk. So this Gemara is the source for what we often quote the principle of mirtas. Mirtas, which means literally to tremble, means that if someone is afraid that they're going to get, they could get caught, so they won't try to play games. It's the same idea which we have elsewhere. I don't know if we encountered or we'll encounter it later in the discussion of Yayin Nesach. I think we have seen it. Yotzei v'nichnas. Right, when you talk about a Mashkiach Tamidi even, I think, you don't need the Mashkiach Tamidi to be watching every single second. He has to be around so that he could walk in at any moment and turn around and look and see what's going on.
Didn't we have this with like the bar? There's only one door in, then you could go in at some point. Didn't we have this?
I don't want to say no. So we may have encountered a case like this that Yotzei v'Nichnas. Later in the Masechta, they talk about the situation of, you know, when you leave when you entrust a non-Jew with your wine, and you leave, how far can you go before you have to be concerned that he's actually going to go in, open it up, stick his hand in the wine, be mishachshech to idolatry, and then seal it up again, right? So it's always a question of the fear of being caught. How much time does he have? What are the chances? So the Gemara says in this case, if the Jew is sitting just on the side of the Eder, and all he has to do is stand up, and he will see exactly what the non-Jew is milking, so then we're not concerned that the non-Jew is going to try to milk from a non-kosher animal. That's what the Gemara's conclusion is. Now, historically speaking, at least in the United States, I don't know what the practice was once upon a time, or always was in terms of the Orthodox community and milk. Reb Moshe has a very, very famous tshuva, very famous response. It's dated 1953 or 54. And Reb Moshe was asked about this particular question. And I don't know the answer to the question, but I wonder what exactly was the practice until then. Meaning, you know, what were Orthodox Jews doing before this tshuva was written? My presumption is that Orthodox Jews were drinking milk without any kind of kosher supervision, on the assumption that it was cow's milk. They were probably machmirim at the time, those who were stringent, who in fact were not drinking milk without without a special hashgacha, without being chal of Yisrael. That's my guess.
Like they do now.
Right.
What's that?
There was no chal of Yisrael.
Like who does now?
Like the people who only drink
chal of Yisrael now. Right. No, the question is what availability was there.
There was none in the United States.
So when Moshe writes this tshuva, there was Chal of Yisrael available already.
But because that's late, that's
50. But I agree.
When
so
I was a kid, there was no Chal of Yisrael.
So I don't know when it started, when it came into being.
In the 50s.
Okay, so before Moshe's tshuva, though, because he writes about it here, that he personally is machmir. So he personally is machmir.
But in his yeshiva, because I was there, we drank regular milk.
Okay. So Reb Moshe,
not everybody. There was a farm in the Bronx, and some people went
to get.
Oh yeah, that's to get special milk.
Right. So I think I mentioned before, ironically, that today most of our community is not machmir on Chol of Yisrael. There are very rare circumstances where it actually is necessary. I remember a number of years ago, a cousin of my wife's said he'd like to make his own mozzarella cheese. And it's much better to make it if you're using unpasteurized milk. So he had two shailas. Shaila number one was, does the rennet that he purchases require hashgacha? Let's say it's vegetable rennet. And number two, he'd like to go to a farm, you know, a couple hours north of Atlanta, and buy unpasteurized milk. You can't buy it in the stores, apparently, by law. Maybe it's changing, but by law, it can't be sold there. So the interesting thing is that the rennet, when I heard this, I knew what the answer was. The rennet is not a problem. In other words, vegetable rennet doesn't require hashgacha. That doesn't mean cheese doesn't require hashgacha, but if vegetable rennet itself does, okay. The rennet itself doesn't require hashgacha. And if you buy that rennet and you take it with milk, that's not a problem. The second question is the problem, the Chol of Yisrael problem, which is that if you don't see them actually milking the animal, so there's no government supervision in that context, which is what Reb Moshe introduces here. So the leniency that Reb Moshe, you know, introduces here actually would not be applicable under those circumstances. But we'll read Reb Moshe's tshuva. So there are actually two tshuvos here, one after the other. And of course, it's Reb Moshe's very charming way of spelling his transliteration of the English words. So he begins, "Uvedvar hachalav shel companies b'medina senu." So the milk of the companies in our country, asher yesh pikuach hamemshala, there is government supervision. "V'im yaravu chalav chalei behema tmeya," if they mix in non-kosher milk, particularly when they're marking it as cow's milk, "yei onshu," they'll be punished. "V'gam yaskiru es ha'esek shalahem," and they'll shut down their business, which is an issue that Reb Moshe then addresses. Somebody challenged them on that. They make him pay fines, but Reb Moshe comes to that in next tshuva. "Shelachein vaday mirtasi mila'arev." Therefore, they're certainly afraid. They don't want to get caught mixing in non-kosher milk. And he uses that word from the Gemara, mirtas. "Yesh tam gadol lahatir af belo shitas ha'prichadash," which I have not been able to find what Reb Moshe is referring to. I don't know what that prichadash is. So Ramosha says there's plenty of good reason to be lenient. Mishum de ha'ikar, the primary point, at least when it comes to Chalav Yisrael, is that the primary issue is the yediyah brurahu kere'iyah mamish. That knowledge, even without seeing, is the equivalent of re'iyah. The example in the Gemara in Shavuos seems to be a situation where you walk into you have a pen of animals, of camels, and you find one animal that's acting crazy, one gamel, that's gamel ocher ben hagmalim, and on the ground you find a wounded camel, and you're trying to figure out who's responsible for the wounding the camel. And the answer is, presumably, the gamel ha'ocher. Right? Even though you didn't see it, you actually know it. Interestingly enough, when it comes to dinei nefashos, that isn't the case. When it comes to capital punishment, that isn't the case. There's a famous story the Gemara tells of Shimon ben Shetach, who walked into a ruin, a churva, and he saw one guy standing there with a knife in his hand, dripping blood, and his other friend stabbed to death on the ground. And Shimon ben Shetach says to us, we all know that you did it. Said, Ben HaKadosh Baruch Hu said, Al pi shnayim edim, ayum asameis, and therefore I can't do anything. Ben HaKadosh Baruch Hu is going to get you, and a snake comes out and bites and kills the would-be murderer. But the point is that the Beis Din cannot actually rely upon what is clear, what is yediya, and that under those circumstances. But by dinei mamonos, Ramosha says, the Gemara Shavuos says that you can. Ugedolu mizo, even greater than that, not just when it comes to monetary issues. Isa betosos yivamos daf memhei b'shem yesh mefarshim. Tosos yivamos, in the Sugya of Geirus, discussing conversion. So one of the things the Gemara says in trying to prove that someone would presumably be considered Jewish is that milo tava lekerio, and a woman milo tava lenidusa. Presumably, if the man has a mila, all they're lacking is tevila. So you know that if they basically observe it, you know they've been going to the mikveh anyway. So the question Tosas asks is, that's very nice, but we usually assume that tevila has to be done in front of a beis din. If you don't have a beis din there, it's very nice. But the tevila for conversion, again, today bisman hazeh, a man requires mila and tevila and acceptance of mitzvos, and a woman requires tefillah and acceptance of mitzvos, and it's clear that the tefillah must be done in front of a beis din. So Tosa says, what kind of an argument is that, that she is considered Jewish because milo tavla l'nidusa, that she certainly went to the mikveh for being a nida? That's very nice, but that still doesn't mean that that's a good tefillah, a good immersion for the purposes of geirus. It wasn't done in front of a beis din. So Tosa, in one answer, suggests that it's an anansadeh. And a non-sadeh means literally we are witnesses. It's what we call an umdana. It's an assumption. And it's a very good assumption. It's a very strong assumption. So Tosa says that. So Ramosha quotes Tosa as saying Yesh Mefarshim Gam Ledin Riyas based on the Tfilas Ger. Tosus in one answer suggests that Beis Din doesn't actually have to see the ger immersed. There's a second teretz where Tosus assumes the Beis Din actually does have to see it, which is the one that that's the view that's accepted. But Tosus certainly considers the possibility that mere virtually certain knowledge, it's obviously always virtually certain, it's not certain, but virtually certain knowledge that something occurred is actually considered proof that the thing occurred.
Tevila doesn't require das.
Tevila.
So you would say
the following, that if the essence is Kabbalah's HaMitzvos, then if you're going, in other words, when she does Tevila Finidus, it means that she accepts basically Mitzvos, because that's why she's going to the Mikveh. So Ramosha concludes the paragraph, V'zehu Geder Anan Sohadeh Shematzinu Bahar Be'Mekomos. This is the definition. The Gemara often invokes this principle. The Rishonim invoke this principle, Anan Sohadeh, which actually literally means, if you actually look, most people in the Ksubos say it's fallen out of the Ksubos, but if you look at the good editions of Ksubos, after you list the date, and such a day, and such a place, it then begins Anan Sohadeh, because the Ksuba is written in the language of the witnesses. If you look at just the text of the Ksuba, you know, when a husband writes a get for his wife, he writes, it's written in the first person, it's as if it's the husband speaking. But when a Ksuba is written, it's actually the language of the witnesses. So the witnesses say that we saw the following, and the Chassan said this, and the Kala said, agree to that, and the Chassan promised the following, and then we made a kinyan with the Chassan. That's the language of the Ksuba. So the good editions actually begin right after the date and place with Anan Sohadeh, which means literally, we are witnesses. In fact, this week's Parsha, you have the only two pure Aramaic words in the Torah, Yigar Sohadusa, which is a translation of Gal Eid. Yigar Sohadusa. That's the word. Samach it's sin in biblical Hebrew, later samach hey dalid, sahed, is a witness. So Rav Moshe says that's what anan sadeh is. Whenever we have an anan sadeh, which is not literally we witnessed, but anan sadeh is a term that's used for an umdana. We know this happened because that's the way the world works. That's the way people behave. So Rav Moshe says that every anan sadeh basically works like that. We don't actually see it, but we know that it happened because that's the way things normally happen, and that's considered sufficient knowledge in many areas of halacha, and therefore Rav Moshe says in our context, because the non-Jew is afraid to take chances of getting caught, of mixing in the non-kosher milk, so there is an anan sadeh, that's what Nir Tess is, anan sadeh, that he actually didn't do it, and therefore we know that there is no kosher non-kosher milk mixed in here. So he continues, after an extended discussion of some very interesting anan sadehs, v'lochein b'chalav she'asru rak b'chalav o'akum v'ein Yisrael ro'ehu, in the case of chalav akum, chalev akum, where it's only if the non-Jew milked it where the Jew doesn't see him, yesh lahatir gam b'Yisrael yodim yediyah berura, it should be sufficient if the Jews know with certainty that there's no kosher milk, the havei k'ri'iyah, that's the equivalent of ri'iyah. Vizeh she'im yarvu ye'onshu. If they mix in, they'll be punished. V'yitzdarchu liskar esek shalahem. They'll have to close down their business. Shehu harvacha shokama alafim will cost them thousands of dollars. V'hamem shalom ashkachas aleim huvada yidia barura shehi kiraya shelo haya bechlal isurim. It was never included in the gzera. In other words, the gzera, as the Gemara makes clear, is that the Jew doesn't actually have to see the milking. He has to be in a position to ensure that the non-Jew would not have been able to mix in non-kosher milk without getting caught. So Rav Moshe thinks that this is the equivalent here. Vizehu gam l'chulei alma, the ein tam lachlok bazeh. There's no matter which sheet that you hold in various issues, everybody should agree to this. V'lochein harotze lismoch ulahakel. Someone who wants to rely upon this and be lenient. Yesh lo tam gadol. It's a very good reason. V'rashai kemosha mekilim bazeh harov b'nei adam shomrei Torah. Most observant Jews are makel on this, are lenient. V'gam harbe rabbonim, and many rabbis. V'chas v'shalom lomar sha'osim shalo kedin. God forbid you suggest they're all violating the halacha. As we've mentioned before, there seems to be, Rav Moshe doesn't say this here, but there seems to be a particular issue, as Tosus points out, in not wanting to assume that Talmidei Chachamim ate non-kosher food. The Gemara says that if HaKadosh Baruch Hu is not maybe takala idei behemtan shel tzadikim, because Pinchas ben Yair's donkey wouldn't eat the untithed food, so certainly tzadikim atzman. So Tosus asked the question, but we have a Gemara in Shabbos that says Rabbi Shmuel ben Elisha was reading on Shabbos and he wasn't careful and he was using the orha, the candlelight, and he accidentally tilted the candlelight and he wrote on his writing tablet that when the Beis HaMikdash is rebuilt, I'm going to bring a fat chatas. So Tosus says, what do you mean tzadikim, nothing bad happens? So Tosus says, no, Machalos Asuris is worse than everything else. So the assumption is that even if a tzaddik and a big Talmud Chacham would be accidentally make a mistake and violate a halacha, it wouldn't be, God wouldn't let him eat non-kosher food. So Rav Moshe assumes it's not conceivable that these people are behaving improperly. It must be mutter, and the question is why, and Rav Moshe has just explained why. Avol mikom makom, he says, lebalei nefesh min haroi lahachmir. For bal nefesh, it's appropriate to be machmir, ve'ein b'zeh mishum yora, and it's not considered gaiva, arrogance, that you're more machmir, that you're treating yourself as superior. What is a bal nefesh? I don't know exactly what a bal nefesh is, but Rav Shechter likes to quote Rav Yehuda Amital, Zichrono Livracha, who used to say that when he was a kid in Europe and they learned Mishnah Berurah, and the Mishnah Berurah said Ubal Nefesh Yachmi Latzmo, that Ubal Nefesh should be machmir himself, Rav Amital said, I used to say, oh, that's not me, so that's not a problem. And today, every yeshiva bacha reads the Mishnah Berurah, says Ubal Nefesh Yachmi Latzmo, says, oh, that's me, I'm a Ubal Nefesh. So no, that's not the case. Ubal Nefesh means someone who really is who observes all the dinim that he's supposed to observe in the first place, not as chumras, and then when he's reached that particular level and he's of a particular madrega, so then he's a Ubal Nefesh. So Rav Moshe says that the I also machmir for myself, so I think we could all agree that Rav Moshe was bal nefesh. But lots of other people who would want to be machmir are not necessarily bali nefesh. Avo misha rotze lahokel, someone who wants to be lenient, who osa kedina, he's behaving properly. The ein lahachshivo kimizalzal beisurim. And there's no reason to regard him as someone who is careless and reckless when it comes to violating halacha. Rav Moshe in this tshuva addresses one last question, which is a broader issue that comes up. There is a halacha that if a person takes on a particular practice, either explicitly accepts it upon him or herself, a particular chumrah, or even without explicitly accepting it, repeats the action three times, then it is treated as a neder, at least mid the rabbanon. And in order to permit doing it, one would require hataras nedarim. So Rav Moshe says, uvim echad nohag lahachmir. If person himself, if someone had a minhag to be stringent, in nesar midin minhag, if it becomes prohibited as a minhag and he's bound by it, at least without hataras nedarim, minhag gimel pamim talya depends upon im haisa kavanaso lahachmir, af im hadin hu lahatir. If in fact his intent was to be stringent, it is permissible. V'kol shekein biyada ba'atzmo sheyesh lahatir. And certainly, if he knew that it was mutter, but he chose to be machmer, umikol makom nohag isur. So in that case, Rav Moshe says yesh alav isur neder de nohag gimel pa'amim. If in fact, if his kavana was either, he wasn't sure whether it was mutter or not, but he decided, I'm going to be machmir no matter what, even if it happens to be mutter. Or, even more so, if he knew that it was permissible, but he said, I want to be machmir. So Rav Moshe says, if he did it three times, if he didn't explicitly accept it, but he repeated the action three times, presumably that means he came to a meal in which he had a choice of either taking the Chalav Yisrael milk or the non-Chalav Yisrael milk, or he was in the supermarket and could have bought the Chalav Yisrael milk or the non-Chalav Yisrael milk, because if he came into the house and all you served him was Chalav Yisrael, that's not choosing to be machmir, that's choosing to use the only choice available to you. But on the assumption that he had a choice, and three times he was presented with the choice, and he was machmir to be makpid on the Chalav Yisrael, so the Rav Moshe says, he's bound mitam neder. Again, you can do hatara. Aval im hechmir mishum shaya sabur sha'asr midina. If he was machmir because he thought it was asr, or at least he thought, oh, af rak sha'asr misafek, and he thought, he wasn't sure, but he thought, it's probably asr, at least if we're not sure. V'choshav ala makilim sh'ulai toan bedin, o sh'ulai hei mezalzal b'isur. Now, we knew that a lot of people aren't concerned about it. So Rav Moshe says, what was he thinking about those people? He either thought those people were making a mistake, or he thought those people weren't so frum. Which, if that's the case, but he really thought it was asr, or at least safek that it was asr. So then Rav Moshe says, ein alav din neder mitzad min hago, v'ein tzarech heter. In that case, it's not even a neder at all. You don't require hataras nedarim. Hataras nedarim is only required for a minhag of chumrah when you know that it's mutter and you choose to do it anyway. But if you do something thinking that it's genuinely prohibited and you repeat the action, that's not binding mitam neder, because that's in effect that would be a neder b'taos. That's a neder taken under false pretenses. Marshall?
Three quick questions. Mm-hmm. One, when you're teaching, how do you decide that, for example, Rav Amital gets a zichron lebracha and Rav Moshe doesn't?
Can't hear you.
No, there was no conscious attempt to distinguish there. Although, to me, Rav Moshe was a person who was a posek hador in my circles, in my generation, when I was still alive. But yes, there's no intent to take away his alpha from Rav Moshe.
Two, is there such a thing, going back to the case of your friend in north of Atlanta?
Yes.
You would imagine in modern America, where A, it's pretty hard to find non-kosher animals being milked, and the economics of non-kosher animals being milked in makes no sense. A dairy farm is likely to have only cows, for example. Are there examples in halacha of social sanction, which very often takes the place of law? For example, if you had artisanal vegan cheese, if it was ever found out you were missing different animals, you would functionally be out of business,
right?
Because of media and the like. In other words, this notion of only legal sanction is enough to give you comfort that people won't act perfidiously actually seems a little bit narrow.
So I agree with that as a general rule. In other words, like Ramosha, so the person responded and challenged Ramosha, saying that if you look at the next tshuva, that on the second line, v'afshik towards the end, v'afshik klo toras or shalach li tshuva me pikira shilton. He sent it from someone who works, some official works in the government. Sheona shalzehu rak me esrim chamisha ad mea dollar. V'gam he mekabli shochta. In other words, the fine is very small, and you can bribe your way out of it. So Ramosha goes a different route, but I would have said that in this case the issue is not the government fines. The issue would ruin your business, right? Know what your people buy from. Not going to buy from you anymore if they don't trust you. So I think that is true. So you could apply that. The only question is it would have to be a circumstance under which that umdana was present. So I would just say, again, do I think that this farm, you know, north of Atlanta is actually going to be using non-kosher milk? No. But they don't really have a business of people coming to them that they have to be worried about selling. Oh, how many people come to them buying the unpasteurized milk that if I one time slip in and I get caught, it's the end of the world. That guy's not going to come to me anymore, but that's not their business. So I think that you're right in principle. I think that would even be a better argument than Ramosha if you're talking about a big company. But so I think generally that's correct. I'm not sure it's correct in that circumstance. But yes.
They've actually done, there's a very famous study in Israel where they actually started fining parents who picked their kids up late from daycare.
I know the reverse. And then they took it as a heter because now, okay, that's the cost.
So the kasha and Ramosha is actually quite legitimate.
So I agree. I think that the real issue is the loss of business, loss of reputation.
Right. But I wanted to really ask about the neder part and the hatar neder, because that actually strikes me, if it has practical halachic obligations, as terrifyingly dangerous, which is any time, and let's use Chol Yisrael as an example. Let's say I don't hold by it. But, you know, whatever, like I'm feeling particularly frum 1 month. When I go to Fairway, you know, I decide, oh, or, it's Elul, like why not be Machped where you can? Is it literally halacha that if three times you decide on a stringency that you don't normally hold, that you have done the equivalent of taking a neder?
Without invoking the neder, yes.
That's your new minhag, and you're not allowed to.
Unless it were like, if you decided during Chodesh Elul, there are people who are Machped on Pas Akum, not to eat, not to rely upon the leniencies of Paspalto during the Aser Shnei Teshuvah. It's mentioned in the Shulchan Aruch, right, that's an appropriate minhag. So if you probably did that, I don't know if you did it 3 years in a row, or you...
No, different issue. Sorry. That I get. That's easy. Right. I decide every year during Elul I'm only going to eat not going to eat Pasakum. I get that. That's not... I'm just saying one Elul, I decide, you know, Rosh Hashanah is coming. It wasn't a very good year for me spiritually. You know, I'm going to have Chol Yisrael. Monday comes, Wednesday comes, Friday comes. I didn't make it just for Elul.
If your intent was to keep that long term, then yes, three times, even without explicit acceptance, is something that requires Hataras B'Darim. It's a Neder Midrabbanan, but yes, that is correct. That's the minhag of three times.
It would seem three times, if you're doing it just for Elul, then it would be just for Elul.
Correct. In other words,
that's where you choose, you know, during a Hataras B'Darim, I'm not going to do X. Then it becomes binding. But the question is, if you don't have that kavana and you do it during Aser Yom Teshuva, it may be binding all year. That's a little bit more serious.
It's three times in a row, right?
I assume it's three times in a row. In other words, yes. In other words, because otherwise the second time you've undone it. So clearly the first one didn't mean anything. But three times in a row when you're presented with that choice, that should require Taras Nedarim. I think, by the way, that Bizman has said very few people have real Nedarim and Shavuos. For starters, most people don't even... Shavua people do know how to take. Most people don't even know how to take a Neder. That's actually not a Neder. That's really... We call it a Neder, but that's actually a Shavua. That's a Shavua. But people today rarely take Shavua. You know, I have the image in my head, maybe hearing Rabbi Cohn, if the Yeshiva high school student who says, I swear, but those are usually about the past. So it might be a Shavua Sheker, but it's not a Shavua that binds you for the future. But this is probably the most common case where you have something which is something that actually does require Hataras Nedarim. And if a person has that, you know, has that particular circumstance, so then if they realize that there's something that they can no longer do for whatever reason, so they should, you know, get together a Beis Din, or at least a single rabbi, you can put two other people, and go through the process of Hataras Nedarim. So yes.
But what about something like that has no basis in halacha, but is a custom, like wearing a black hat? Somebody starts to wear a black hat because they think it's respectful, and that's what the community does. And then they decide they're going to stop. Is that...
I think usually, and I don't want to say with certainty, usually, I would say the following. If someone chooses to wear a black hat during davening, to be machmir zatifas arosh, they would be bound to wear a hat during davening, cover their head during davening. I don't want them to wear a black hat, or a gray hat, or a hat, and so on. I think it does have to have a basis in some basis in some halacha, a chumrah of a particular din. You know, I think that if a person, you know, makes it a habit to go to the Mets game every Sunday, so I don't think that we would say that, well, after they've gone three Sundays, they don't have to go to the Mets game every single Sunday. Presumably there has to be a basis, or Yankees, sorry, I don't mean to two sides here, So it has to be a basis. There has to be a tzad, that why it would be, considered halachically meaningful. So again, if the I would say to walk around with a hat of any color, but walk in the street, I'm not sure that actually is meaningful. But perhaps during davening, that might be some type of minhag. Again, I don't know if the color would matter, but it might be that you could wear a cap and you could wear a hat, but it'd be a tifas harosh during davening. So, okay. So Rav Moshe was challenged in the second tshuva. And I want to just really read one piece of the tshuva, which I think is the most interesting from a halachic perspective.
Who challenged him?
The name on the first tshuva, and I assume it's the same person, was Rav Yehuda Dick. I don't know who that is. It's a name I've actually heard in the context of the prenup, an earlier version of the prenup. I have no idea who he is, though. But Rav Moshe, but he asked Rav Moshe the following question. There is a principle in... The question is, what is the purpose of witnesses in halacha? So generally speaking, we tend to think of Eidim as being there for the purposes of proof. In other words, if there's a dispute between two parties, then if one party, how do you prove facts? So the best available information that was that existed in the time of the Gemara, at least until recent times, the best possible proof you could have was eyewitness testimony. Despite any questions today raised about how reliable is eyewitness testimony, that was certainly the best that was available at the time. So the question is, what is the function of the eyewitness testimonies? The Gemara in Kiddushin, I think Daf Samach Hayamud Beis, has one of the Amoraim, I think, asks Rav Ashi. He was talking about, I think he and his brother were dividing up the estate of his father, and the question is, do they need witnesses to the division? What is the purpose of the witnesses? And the response they received was, Lo ivri sade ela l'shakare, that witnesses were only literally created, but required for people who would lie. Meaning, if the two people trust one another, there's no witnesses to make the division of the estate formally binding. As Tosis points out right there, a kinyan does not require edus. In other words, if I want to acquire, Aaron's Gemara, and he picks up my watch as a kinyan sudar, and when he picks up the watch, I take possession of the Gemara. So there doesn't have to be anybody else in this room. If he does that with my permission, the kinyan is binding, and his Gemara belongs to me, and my watch belongs to him. However, since everybody assumes this is my watch and that's his Gemara, if we get into a dispute and I claim I never bought you Gemara and he claims you did bought you Gemara and gave me my watch, and we walk into Beis Din, if he doesn't have witnesses to that, and I have witnesses that let's say no, but neither of us is holding it right now, and I have witnesses that I own the watch this morning, I'm going to win the case even though the watch actually belongs to him because there's no proof. The question is there any area in halacha where witnesses are required not only as proof, but actually in order to make a transaction binding? And the answer is, there's one situation in halacha that's required, and that is kiddushin. That is transacting a marriage. Only the kiddushin, not the second stage of nisuin. Kiddushin requires, the Gemara says, edus l'kiyum hadavar. And if you don't have witnesses there, so then the kiddushin is in binding. Even though the husband-to-be says, I gave her a ring worth a shavaputa, and she says, he gave me this ring, and you can see it's worth hundreds and thousands of dollars, and yes, he was mekadesh me. And even if they have one witness there, al pidin, I think the Rama is machmir to require a get there, but even with one witness, and he says, and she says, they all agree, kiddushin is in binding. Why? Because the halacha is you need edus l'kiyum hadavar. The Gemara actually has a very interesting explanation for it. The Gemara says that you require edus l'kiyum hadavar. Why don't you accept the husband and the wife agreeing? If I borrowed money from Larry and he has no proof, he has no witnesses, but if I come and say, if I say in front of the court or in front of the witnesses, I borrowed $100, they didn't pay it back, even though no witnesses, I'm obligated to pay him back. Why? The answer is, the Gemara says that hodas baldin kamei eidim dami, that when the party that stands to lose, or the parties that stand to lose, admit their liability, that's like 100 witnesses coming forward. You can't have better proof than that. Why would I lie and say $100 to Larry if it's against my interest? So if I say that, that's usually assumed to be considered binding. However, that doesn't always work. Hodas Baldim doesn't work if by my owing Larry the $100, it hurts someone else's case. So let's say I borrowed money from Rabbi Feldman, and then what happens is he comes to collect from me, and I have land worth $100. And I say, you know what? It's nice, but I can't pay give you the land because Larry actually loaned me $100 before you did, and he has prior claim to the land. Now, if there's no proof in this case, that admission is not binding because it's a hodas baldin b'makom shechav la'acharini, where I end up incurring a liability for somebody else. So the Gemara suggests, it's not clear why, that that's why it doesn't work in this particular case. That when a husband, a man and a woman both say, when they say they made the Kiddushin, well, it's not clear what the Chav is, but now no other man can marry her. And therefore, even though they're both admitting to it because there are other parties that theoretically lose in this admission, therefore it's not considered binding. It's an interesting, I remember Ramelech Shechter, Zichron al-Racha, Rav Shechter's father. So when we learned Evan Ezer, he told us the following. It was a story that the Avnei Nezer, they wanted to make a shidduch with him. And apparently so the minhag in Europe, at least certainly, maybe even today, is that the father-in-law, prospective father-in-law, would give the son-in-law a fahir. He would give him a bechina to see if he knew how to learn sufficiently. So anyway, he asked, to make the long story short, he asked him the following question. He said, if, in fact, you need Eidos Lekiyum Hadavar for Kiddushin, had an Adam HaRishon ever marry Chava? Because there were no witnesses around. So the Avnei Nezer responded and said, well, that's not a problem, because the only reason why you need Eidos Lekiyum Hadavar by Kiddushin is because of Bachum Shechav Lachrini, and there were no other men around that would have Chavu no longer to marry, and therefore that's why you need Eidos Lekiyum Hadavar. Okay, I don't take the question that seriously, nor the answer that seriously, but nonetheless. So the principle in Halacha is that Eidos is always what we call the Birur Hadavar, simply to clarify what happened, with the exception of Eidos Kiddushin. Eidos Kiddushin, if all the parties admit, acknowledge what happened, and nonetheless there were no witnesses to see it, it doesn't matter, they're not married. I've always wondered, I don't know the answer to this question, what if there were a video camera, a video recording of it? I suspect the answer would still be no, it's not binding. That you actually need formal Eidos at the time of the Kiddushin, and without that, it is simply not binding, so they are still single. Okay, so in light of that, Rav Moshe was asked the following question. Someone said, maybe you need some type of Eidos Lekiyum Hadavar on the milk. Maybe it's not sufficient to know. Like, we could know that a man and a woman did Kiddushin. One witness even tells us, and both admit it. We're pretty certain they did it, but it doesn't matter because you need Eidos Lekiyum Hadavar. So maybe the same thing is true by the milk. You don't need two Eidim, but you need a Jew to actually witness. So Rav Moshe says, Umashe Ratza Kvod Taraso, the second paragraph, and the small paragraph of the second Tshuva. Umashe Ratza Kvod Taraso Lomar, She'ulai Hitzrichu Dafka Kegeder Eidim Lekiyuma. Maybe they required here an Eidos Lekiyum HaDavar, Zehu Davar Shelo Nitan Lehe Omer. Cannot say that. De'afla Mordechai, De'masik De'af Bein Davar Tamei Be'edro, Tzarech HaChalapachos HaYisrael Yoshe Bibachotz. Even according to those who say that when there's not a single non-kosher animal in his Eder, you need a Jew still to be sitting outside, even though he's not watching him. Hare al kol panim eino yachal l'roso. Nonetheless, he's not able to see him. V'atam, so then why does the Jew have to be sitting out there in the first place? If it's not l'kiyum hadavar, it's clearly not l'kiyum hadavar, Rav Moshe claims, because he doesn't see him. So he says, "Vatam." The reason why the Jew has to be sitting there, "Shetzarach leishe l'chal apachas miachutz, humishum diyesh lachosh shema yatzah akum mehaeder viyazayif." Maybe the guy at some point is going to go out, not at his flock. He's going to bring in some non-kosher milk, and then he'll milk on top of that the kosher milk. As Rav Moshe says, points out, it's mentioned in the Shulchan Aruch. In other words, in order for the milking process to be good with the Jew sitting outside, he has to first see that the pail is empty and that there are no other pails. Otherwise, you don't know that there wasn't non-kosher milk in the pail to start with. If in fact you were in a case where you didn't have to be concerned at all that the non-Jew brought non-kosher milk in from the outside, then lo hayitzarach al kvum, you wouldn't even need the Jew sitting out there. Af she'en kan re'ia. Even though the Jew actually sees nothing, why? Because he knows. Now, one last observation here. So, Rav Moshe here is trying to bring a raya from the fact that the Jew is sitting outside and doesn't actually witness the milking. That's not Eidus Lekiyum Hadavar. You don't see the text of the question, but there's one very interesting case in halacha that comes up in general about this question of what exactly do you have to see. For example, Rav Moshe spoke about in the previous tshuva, I cut it out, it was in the ellipsis. When it comes to catching an adulterous couple and bringing them to court and giving them the death penalty, the Gemara observes that the Edom do not have to see kimachol b'shvoferes. They don't actually have to see penetration. Rather, it's enough to sheyiru kiderech haminoafim. It's enough to see that they looks like they're doing what people do when they have sex. It's not required that, knows, they could be under a blanket and you cannot see. Again, the Gemara's expression is kimachol b'shoferes. There's an umdana where you don't actually see exactly what happened, but that's considered sufficient. Similarly, there is a big discussion in the context of kiddushin. Supposing, you know, this came up in the last couple of years over the controversy with the Beis Din, the new Beis Din for Agunos, which is, what is the status of people in the audience who are not actually called up to witness the kiddushin itself? So the Chasam Sofer, and I think this is the position of the Ramah, but this is a big machlokas, the Chasam Sofer, if I'm not mistaken, assumes that if you're sitting in the audience and you see the Chasam Lekala and you see Hareat Mekudeshesli, I don't remember if it's clear that you even have to actually see the transfer of the ring. If she's now wearing that ring, that's sufficient for the people there to be considered Aiden as well. And if you don't believe that designating witnesses has an impact one way or the other, so then everybody in the audience is actually considered an aid to the Kiddushin, which means that if you want to invalidate a kiddushin on the grounds that the eidim were not shomer Shabbos, you would need everybody in that room, you know, to be pasul le'edus.
Isaac? I've heard, noted that rabbis have said that these are the witnesses to the exclusion of everybody.
This would be a more extended discussion, but yichud eidus is a very, very controversial topic, whether such a thing exists as a general rule. Just imagine the following. I've envisioned the perfect murder. I will bring my brother along with someone else to witness the murder, and before I murder the person, I will designate my brother and this other person as witnesses to the murder to the exclusion of all other witnesses. Does that work? Presumably the answer to that question is no. So the question, the only place where the Gemara says explicitly that Eidos is that you have to designate witnesses is when, if I'm moda on a loan to you, so if I don't say Atem Eidai, it could be that I'm just pulling your leg. I'm not really meaning to you, I'm just humoring you. So in order to know that it's a serious hoda'ah, a serious admission, I have to recognize that it's in front of witnesses and acknowledge them that they should be witnesses to this confession. But outside of that, it's a highly controversial idea. That Ritva is the first one, I think, to mention in Kiddushin, and he got it from his Rebbe, and everybody disagrees, but he doesn't know why. He quotes this idea from his Rebbe. I don't know if he says who it is. Maybe it's the Ra'ah. But it was nobody accepted it. In other words, he thought it made sense that by kiddushin, he was talking about that you could, if you me'achid eidim, then it would exclude other people. But it was a position that was fundamentally rejected by most of the Rishonim. There's an extensive history and discussion to this. There's a very important kitzos and so on. But it's certainly not an uncomplicated matter, let's put it that way. So anyway, I speak about the Chasam Sofer's position because the question is, if I'm in the audience watching, even if I don't see down to the finest detail, that is in effect not really re'iyah, but it's a kind of yediyah. It's not exactly the same as the guy sitting outside from the fence who doesn't see anything, but in effect he has seen. He doesn't have to look over the fence. But anyway, so Ramosha says that no eidos is required. It's not the single eid is not in the category of eidos l'kiyum hadavar for formalizing the act, but rather it's eidos l'biur hadavar for clarifying. And if we have sufficient clarification or sufficient yediyah without the witness, then it's not a problem. And that's the basis on which Ramosha was leaning. So basically, in conclusion, what Moshe said is that the principle of the Gemara of Mirtas, of the non-Jew being afraid of being caught when the Jew is sitting, can see the milking, but stands up and can see the milking, is that very same principle is applicable in the context of commercially produced milk in the United States. You know, commercially produced milk, which is marketed as cow's milk, Ramosha says the same principle of mirtas applies. He, by the way, would not have said that, and I think he's hinted this, he wouldn't have said that by cheese. By cheese, it would appear, cheese, it appears the Jew actually has to, some claim the Jew has to make the cheese, and some claim at least the Jew has to witness the cheese and the rennet being placed in.
They use it in other circumstances. For example, tuna fish. The OU certifies the tuna fish, even though nobody sees them canning the tuna fish, and there's no tray fish there.
On the basis of mirtas? Is that the issue? That
no,
seems
I mean,
strange.
That the company is afraid that they'll get fined.
I don't know if that... I don't know. You sure there's no... there must be hashgacha. No?
Yeah, but there's somebody watching every fish.
Well, you don't have to have somebody watching this. If someone is there and they can check every fish, that's usually enough. In other words, that's like Yotzei v'Nichnas, but that's not the same thing as not having...
I think the principle is that they're just afraid they might get fined.
Again, I agree, afraid is a factor there, but without any mashgiach, I don't know. I don't know if that, so I can't comment. Marcia, you had a question.
I don't understand why this Kasha of Edus on Rav Moshe is at all thoughtful. It just seems sort of stupid to me. I mean, as you just finished, and that's why I was raising my hand for it. The Gemara says beferush that mirtas works. The Jew can't see it. Yotzei v'Nichnas means at its very core that it's not being witnessed continuously. So why is it even a question to say, wait, maybe you need Edus? The Gemara is beferush, you don't need Edus. So why is this a thoughtful question that even needs an answer?
So I think the answer is that... is that there's a machlokas harishonim, it would appear, if there's no davar tame in the eder, do you still require the Jew sitting outside where he could look? And if you do, the question is why? And Ramosha's questioner thought, well, it must be because they did require some Jew present in proximity, even if not actually watching it. It can't be Edus L'Kiyum HaDavar in the classic sense anyway, it's only one witness. But he was suggesting that it was modeled upon Edus L'Kiyum HaDavar, and you require a Jew present in some way, not in the far abstract. And Ramosha's answer, and that you can see from his answer, is that's wrong, because the only reason why the Mordechai would require the Jew be sitting there, even when though there's no non-kosher on the Eder, is because you're afraid the non-Jew left and brought a milk from the outside. But you can see what the Havamina was. In other words, if you didn't accept that principle, then why did they require the Mordechai requires somebody always to be sitting outside the eater. You just need it if there's no non-kosher animal. That's, I think, where the questioner was coming from. I think Ramosha is correct. It's not. It's just a question of birur. But that's where the question was coming from. Adrian?
What if you're not talking about a commercial context? Like you're just at a family farm and someone hands you a cup of milk.
So I think that would be a problem. Right? And that there you need... What? No. If you don't see a milk from the cow. In other words, they go out to the back and then they and they bring a cup of milk. Right. That would be the issue.
Is that really a problem?
I mean, I've never gotten a shaila, but I think so.
Okay.
I think so. I mean, have you ever encountered this?
No.
Right. So okay. You know, so if yes, Aaron.
I have two questions. First of all, if you know the guy doesn't have any pigs on the farm.
So
it's a cow and a few chickens.
Right.
Okay. Then would it be a problem?
It depends whether the cows are treifas. No, I'm kidding. that's different. That's a different discussion.
Right.
So let's say you know there isn't a pig. Why? Right? You don't know whether he had milk there already from non-kosher milk. It's the issue with the Mordechai is still an issue. Right.
If he brings you warm milk, so you're going to assume that he had
non-kosher. Okay, so if you
warmed it up and then gave it.
So if you, I'm going to say, if you know that there's no non-kosher animal within a radius of 50 miles, and you give him the pail, and he walks out, and he gets it, and he brings it back as warm milk, then yes, that would be the equivalent. You know, how far you have to go to the limit? I don't know. I don't usually get this, Shaila. So,
I have heard that, and I know someone who got smicha from Rav Moshe. He basically says that what Rav Moshe believes is that warm milk in the United States is called Yisrael.
Correct. So I think we have a terminology. In other words, people say, "Are you machban on Chol Yisrael?" The answer is, we're all machban on Chol of Yisrael. Because if it weren't Chol of Yisrael, it's usher to eat, to drink.
Right.
Right? You're not allowed to consume it. Ramosha's argument is that what they say, Chol of Stam, is the term that's used. Chol of Stam is the term that's typically used for kosher milk, but without Chol of Yisrael certification. So Ramosha's argument is that Chol of Stam is Chol of Yisrael. He doesn't formulate that way, but that's what it means. So yes, everybody is Makbid. Everybody's concerned about Chol of Yisrael. There's no question about that. The question is, how do you define Chol of Yisrael? So in popular usage, we call Chol Yisrael only the stuff that actually has a Jew supervising, whereas what most of us drink is called Chalav Stam, which Ramosha says has the din of Chol Yisrael. Yes.
With regards to Kedushin, even though we have officially two Eidim,
right,
the rabbi who conducts the event, he's really an aid, isn't he?
Presumably he's kosher for Eidus, but yes.
Right, but then it carries over to what you're saying before about the other matter, which is that everyone who's in the, so to speak, audience sees what's going on, even though they don't see the actual ring, so they
Well, they assume. The question is
that they are the backup to the rabbi to the Eidim, even though they didn't observe it directly.
I don't remember. I don't remember the details of the Chasam Sofer, but yes. The two questions. One, if you designate witnesses, does that disqualify everybody else? And number two, how much, assuming you didn't, how much do you actually have to see? Assuming that nobody was miyached Eidim, they didn't designate witnesses. They called two people up to honor them, and now the question is, how much did you have to? Do you assume that by default, people, depending on what they see in the audience, are actually considered witnesses?
How much did the designated witnesses have to see?
Presumably, whatever the people in the audience have to see. But usually, I know I'm machbit, and both as a witness and as an asad, there is that they actually can see the transfer, you know, that their view shouldn't be blocked. So
I know in Hasidic weddings, girls' faces blocked out.
I'm talking about the witnesses.
Don't know what it's up. What I'm going to say is the following. Without having had the chance to think about this more, that couple is married. The question is, do the Eidim know exactly who the woman is? Is that a requirement? What's that?
Is that a requirement? Right.
That's an interesting question. But... Let me say, the other question is, however, if the witnesses might have seen her earlier, is there an umdana that the woman wearing the wedding dress is the same one as wearing earlier? What I mean by the following, the halacha is you can't get malchus on, let's say for eating chaylev unless two witnesses saw you eat the chaylev. But what happens if before two, let's say I have a piece of meat and nobody knows what it is, and one witness comes forward and says, I know that that's chaylev. And then you go ahead and subsequent and you eat it, and two witnesses see you. The halacha is you get malchus. In other words, some of the underlying fact can be established without edus, and it's only some of the final action. So if they saw at some point the kala, they could identify who she was. Then it might not be necessary that they can actually see under the veil at the time of the chuppah.
I'm pretty sure they're not checking around afterwards.
What's that?
I'm pretty sure they're not checking around afterwards. They don't go on the other side of the wall.
Okay. Right. I know. It's an interesting question. It's
One last thing.
Yes.
The idea of the presumptive aidus, isn't that the issue with tefillah for conversion of women?
They can switch around.
Well, that's the sheet in Tosos. One sheet in Tosos says that again, it's not an our cases. It was a case where there was some. The Gemara's case was there a situation where someone was slandered as being the child of a non-Jewish woman, whom we knew to be acting as living as part of the Jewish community. And so the one of the Amorim said, "We're not concerned. Milo tavla l'nidusa. She certainly went to the mikveh for her nidus." So the question is, let's assume that since she's doing it as part of Kiyum HaMitzvah, that's good, that it's sort of a redoing of Geirus, even if there weren't one, but nonetheless you need witnesses to the tefillah. That was Tosa's question. And the one answer, it's not the answer that's accepted, one answer is, we know that an Anan Sade, that she went to the mikveh, and that's enough, right? The other answer is that no, it's difficult how you fit it in the Gemara, but actually you actually would require, you know, witnesses.
But the current issue is about men.
Are there rishitos in Rishonim that would say, are there deos in Rishonim that would say that the Beis Din could stand outside the room and won't go in? The answer is probably yes, but the Shulchan Aruch doesn't actually paskin that way. So that's why. So the question is, what does the how to deal with that particular issue? But yes, there do exist opinions that would justify, and I suspect there might have been communities once upon a time where the practice might have been that, where they actually weren't literally in the room, they were right outside the room. So such an opinion does exist, let's put it that way. Okay, so that's the story of our Chalav Stam and why Rav Moshe treated it as Chalav Yisrael. Just as for the grammarians amongst us, I'll just note that we say Chalav Yisrael, but it actually should probably be pronounced Chalav Yisrael. But I'll just leave it at that. It's not Lo Sevashel Gedli B'Chalav Imo, but B'Chalav Imo. So, fine. Now the Gemara goes on to honey. V'had Devash. That was this next line in the Mishnah. Honey, according to the Mishnah, according to the Gemara, and according to the Halacha, as far as I can tell, does not... I'm afraid to say it doesn't require kosher certification. Somebody's going to tell me why it does, but not Aaron, I understand that. Mm. Someone else will tell me...
I can tell you that many honeys have kosher certification.
They do. The question is whether they actually need it or not. All right, that's a separate discussion. So the Gemara says that honey purchased from a non-Jew does not require kosher. It does not require kosher certification. May be purchased from a non-Jew, and we're not concerned about the honey not being kosher. So the Gemara says, "What's that?
Raw honey.
Are you talking about as opposed to
flavored honey?
Oh, right, correct. Talking raw. They were talking about that raw honey. V'had devash. So the Gemara says the following, explaining. We're about eight lines from the bottom of Lamed Tes Amid Beis. Hadvash. Dvash. Lamai Nechashlai. What would we be concerned about that you'd even say? And the Gemara is explaining why it's kosher. In other words, the concerns could have been A, B, and C, and they're not concerns. First one. I Mishum I Aruve. If you're concerned about the non Jew mixing something in, the Gemara doesn't say what they're mixing in. Then the Gemara says it's not a problem, misrasari, because it will ruin the honey. It will cause it to spoil. Rashi says, I aruve, the second Rashi, right after the Gemara starts, I aruve shema irev bo yayin. Mm. If the concern is that he mixed in wine, it says it's not a concern because it will cause the honey to spoil. So that can't be it. There are other Rishon in the Rambam who claims actually the concern is actually over meat. Which provokes a very interesting machlokas harishonim, whether meat and honey is yummy tasting or not yummy tasting. But anyway, leave that aside for the moment. Let's just follow Rashi. Imishum bishuleakum, maybe if the goyim cooked the honey. So the Gemara says, nechau kamo shuchai. The Gemara says there's no problem of bishul nachri, bishul akum, when the substance can be eaten without being eaten raw. And honey, most honey, I assume, I don't think it's cooked.
That's where the problem.
When the cooking...
Companies they warm up the honey. I'm not sure why they do it. Right. There is a process of doing it. And that's why on the cheaper honeys you do need ashram.
Well, the question is, though, what's the concern? Even if they warm the honey, what's the concern?
I'm not sure.
But you'll see in a second why I asked what the concern is. Because the Gemara says the following. The next step is... if you're afraid that the non-kosher stuff of a non-Jew in the walls of their pots that they used, let's say they heated the honey, right? The Gemara is assuming they cooked the honey, right? If you're concerned about the kalim that it was cooked in, the Gemara says no sein tam lefgam hu mutter, that it's considered no sein tam lefgam. The question only, of course, is why is no sein tam lefgam? Why is it no sein tam lefgam? There are two possibilities. Possibility one, which would then mean you should never require hashgacha, would be that anything in honey is detrimental to the flavor of the honey. So if anything came out of the walls of the pot, it would be no sein tam lefgam, and that would be permissible. The second option is that the assumption being made here is that stam kalim of non-Jews are not b'nei yomon, meaning the assumption is that by default the kalim haven't been used in 24 hours, and therefore any kli which hasn't been used in 24 hours, even if you cooked all the treif in the world in it, but it's clean and hasn't been used in 24 hours, and you're not cooking a sharp food, and honey isn't sharp, then the food you cook in such a pot is kosher. The pot is treif, but the food is still kosher. So if you're afraid that they cook the honey in non-kosher pots, it doesn't matter because it's no sein tam lefgam. If you believe that that's the reason why, not that things in honey are pogame, that flavors that are normally positive but in honey are detrimental, if you believe it's that the kalim haven't been used normally in 24 hours, so that's the only way you could have a problem, if you adopt that position. If you argue that they're cooking the honey, and since they're doing it in an industrial context, they're running other things through that line, which might have treif ingredients, and now they run regular honey through it, and they cook it, and that's a concern. I don't know the industrial process. It seems to me a pretty remote concern. Although I get the sense generally that at least the honey we buy is raw. They say, I think, not to feed it to little babies because they're afraid of the immune system and certain bacteria or something like that. So certainly when you're dealing with raw honey, that's very clear from the Gemara, from the Mishnah and the Gemara, that that it doesn't require hashgacha, because we're A, not concerned they mix in anything, it will cause it to spoil. B, we're not concerned about bishul, even if it's cooked, bishulei nachrim, because it's edible raw. And C, even if they cooked it in their kelim, the assumption is that in the honey, either because anything in honey is no sein tam lefgam, or perhaps because we're assuming that the kelim haven't been used for 24 hours, and therefore those absorptions emitted into food, any food pretty much, are considered no sein tam lefgam. And what you see from this gemara, I conclude, and Tosas pointed this out early in the parak, two things. Number one, you see that we paskin no sein tam lefgam is mutter, because that's what the gemara just assumes. And number two, we paskin, when it comes to bishulei nachrim, that something that is nechal kamo shuchai is permissible. Because there were two different answers in the gemara, two different leniencies in the gemara early. When are you allowed to eat bishulei nachrim? Either nechal kmo shuchai or enum olal shulchan malachim. We happen to adopt both, but from this gemara, it's very, very clear that we paskin for sure that if it's nechal kmo shuchai, if the food may be eaten raw, there is no concern at all that it was cooked by an achri. Aaron.
And the fact that bees aren't kosher.
So that you're asking, like a pig's milk is not kosher. So why isn't? So the gemara in Bechoros, I think Daf Hei.
But I think scientifically it's improved.
What's for proof?
The Gemara in Mechoros, he was just assumes that somehow the honey is not really a product of the bee. It's sort of like a waste product or something like that. It's just a pass-through, which on some level it is, but the same thing can be said for non-kosher milk as well. In other words, it's probably a product of the nectar and the honey and the bee process it and so on. So the Gemara wants to know if you have a principle, a yotze min atameh, tame, that which comes from a non-kosher animal, is not kosher, so that's why you can't eat milk from a camel. So why, the Gemara asks, why is the honey permissible? How do you know honey is permissible? So you can't tell me Eretz Zavas Chalav Udavash, because that honey is not bee honey, that is actually date honey. So the proof, however, is because there are a couple of places in Tanakh, both Shimshon and Yonasan. I'm not sure I want to bring so many rayas from Shimshon, but aside from one particular area Shimshon was probably from, he had one particularly blind spot. he didn't hold of Eben Ezer so much, okay? The other three, what's that?
Arguably Yonatan had a problem too for another day.
That's an awful reading, I just want to tell you. That is a twisted modern reading, which I want to say is wrong. But either way, no reason to assume Shimshon had a problem with Yoredea, nor Yonasan, and they both taste and eat from the honey, and Shimshon's parents certainly didn't have that problem, so he also gave them to eat, and they didn't question it.
That's not a riot, because if they're basing it on false science, now we know today that answer is wrong.
So this is a case where I'm very, very comfortable invoking Rav Dessler's approach, which I'm usually not, which is sometimes the din was known, and the only question is whether the reason given correct or not. So this is a case where we start out with the din being known, and the only question is, why is it that it's considered prohibited? That's considered permitted in this case. So... You should be glad, because that's the way Psak Halacha usually worked recently, which is when Klal Yisrael has been doing something, as Ramosha assumes here, it's mutter, and the only question is why. The alternative approach is, my parents were doing it, my grandparents were doing it, and they were very pious Jews, but I read in a book now, it says you're not allowed to do it, so I can't eat in my parents' kitchen because of that. So that's not the way Halacha has ever historically worked, and that, what you're seeing in the Gemara, is the very same thing. They knew the starting point that honey was mutter, and they knew that non-kosher milk was us, and the only question is, how exactly do you explain the difference between them? So, okay, very good.